a very useful conversation, notwithstanding the technology. I've been given a very specific brief, and that is, if you can see me, to introduce this guy to peacemaking using Islamic principles. It's a guy that the team of us has worked on for a while, since about 2019-2020. It was a point at which there was some hope that Afghanistan and the Taliban could be persuaded to enter a peace process and to plan for what could follow their reintegration and after the American withdrawal. For a while, it was very, very hopeful, because we were able to speak through quite a few things, such as transitional governance, a developmental program, but most importantly also constructing a step clock that avoids the violence of, on the one hand, a totalitarian Islamism, on the other hand, the idea of everything not Islamist being hostile. And the three-way conversation was facilitated by us, but it included representatives from the then Afghan government, from the Taliban, and from Afghan civil society. We thought at that point that that was the appropriate moment to introduce the idea of Islamically grounded peacemaking, conflict resolution, and statecraft. And we styled it as overcoming the conversation of the deaf, because we thought we have an entire history in the Muslim world of us speaking past each other. And I have found it particularly important to understand the importance and the centrality of bringing peace to the Muslim soul, given the fact that I have developed, for my own understanding, a theory that I call 70 by 70. What I mean by that is that in the 70 years since World War II, the world has been engulfed in conflict, of which about 70% have involved Muslims, either by virtue of what was done to them or by them. And therefore, it goes back to 1947, the independence of India, the partitions that were particularly bloody. It goes back to 1948, the establishment of the State of Israel, that goes right to today's Gaza situation. It goes Afghanistan, the Soviet invasion, the American occupation, one and two, the Taliban, and all of those right up to today. It goes to the decolonization process in countries like Indonesia, Algeria, and so forth. So by and large, we are looking at it that even goes for contemporary purposes to the 1953 coup in Iran that overthrew the democratically elected Mossadegh, and therefore the Islamic Revolution and today's war that we are seeing. So our understanding was, how do these conflicts involving Muslims persist despite some of the best efforts in peacemaking, conflict resolution, and statecraft? And we came to some kind of conclusion because we stress-tested this conundrum. We stress-tested it with Muslim politicians, with clergy, and then later with the peacemaking community, and then later all of them together in an Istanbul process. where we started putting some of the frameworks together for Islamic ground, conflict resolution, peacemaking, and statecraft. And particularly, our engagement with the Taliban was like a real laboratory. How long can we keep the Taliban in the process, utilizing the resources of Islam, the prophetic tradition, and the Quran, and Muslim history, in order to keep them very much in the process? And that was before we were beginning to make a breakthrough until Joe Biden, early in his presidency, not only honored the incoming Donald Trump's promise of the global from Afghanistan, but speeding it up in a very chaotic way, that all of that work really did not matter any longer. So the first question, therefore, is why do we feel the need for Islamically grounded peacemaking and statecraft other than the persistent and consistent conflicts and wars involving Muslims and Muslim spaces? So we did not take a violent approach with traditional Western formulas of peacemaking and conflict resolution. We thought that they had developed critical tools, but they have not always proven to be sustainable. Secondly, we picked up a lot of suspicion with regard to what was seen as Western-imposed peacemaking ceasefires and so forth, and there have been histories of betrayal and power politics, particularly from the West, and I dare say we are living through much the same kind of accusations that the United States invited to talks and then bombs. The third reason is that we wanted to draw on credible resources from within the tradition of Islam to resolve conflicts afflicting the Western Muslim world for the last 7 decades, and therefore we also needed finally a way to conduct two conversations at the same time, an intra-Muslim and inter-community process. And so, by and large, that was what we have been doing. And so, what this work therefore represents is a process to overcome violence between the Islamic traditions and the traditional Western traditions, and looking for convergences. And so those convergences show enormous intersection with significant differences in between the two. We also felt that the irreconcilable binaries are quantitatively small, but qualitatively significant. The third one is that the challenge may end up to be rooted in need of trade-offs and resistance to harmonizing. But the use of traditional Islamic sources, the Quran and the prophetic tradition, provides authenticity, legitimacy, identity, and removes suspicion, conspiracy, and sense of imposition. And so those were the kind of things that we began to look at. So you may ask, where would there be divergences? So for example, in the Western tradition, the mediator is often seen as absolutely neutral. Whereas in the Islamic tradition, the mediator must have an orientation to what is the just outcome that is required and invites the two parties towards that just outcome, rather than finding a median point between the two poles in a conflict. So that's a significant difference, and may allow us to say, on the basis of our Islamic traditions, your killing of civilians is absolutely wrong. And therefore, we've got to get you to that point first, where we deal with it like that. I also think that the critical point that we introduce that is often missed by the Western tradition is the point of statecraft, because the default of Muslims in a conflict is often to defer to Islam, whereas the default of the Western tradition is to try and say, we've got to get to a democracy with liberal freedoms and rights and all of those kind of things. And often, for example, what we do in our model is that we never use, for example, the F word, feminism, to reorder the gender relations. But what we do is to pull from the tradition of the wives of the Prophet and to say, what justification would the Taliban have to say women can't work when the Prophet's wife was not just a businesswoman, but she employed him. And so we were able to manage this. How can the Taliban bar women from education when the Prophet's wife Aisha was in fact the teacher of the schools of thought in Islam? And so it changes the debate, but reaches more or less the same outcomes. And similarly with the kinds of states we envision. And so we may not speak immediately about the Bill of Rights or the human rights charter, but we do speak about what the Arabic is called the Maqasid al-Sharia, the intents and the objectives and the higher values of Islamic law and Islamic system. And when you get to those 7 points, you begin to see enormous convergences. In fact, those 7 subsume quite a few of the articles of any other rights. And so the right to life, the right to social development, the right to education, etc., etc. And so how do you construct a state out of that? And so we present a palette of statecraft that for our purposes had about 5 columns. On the edges would be the Islamist one. On the other edge is what Muslims see as hostile. And again, it's not secular. It is secularist in the form of like Islam there, which often comes across as anti-religion. At the same time, that hostility can be authoritarianism. And so our purpose is to shift away from the edges towards the center. And next to the Islamic one is what we call Dawla Madaniya, or the civil state, which has a strong religious overtone, incorporates the intents and higher values of the religion, but has some regulatory form on personal law, on worship laws, and a few other things such as inheritance, etc. But next to the other extreme of the hostile state, we have the Dawla Imamiyya, the secular state, where the state is not anti-religion, but it separates state from religion, but is not hostile, and in fact has some accommodations for Islam. But in the middle, between those two, would be the Dawla Muwadana, the citizenship state that can fit the higher intent of Islam as a Bill of Rights, can incorporate aspects of personal law and allows for worship, but does not use Islam as a body of law itself. It's not a set of rules and regulations, but a set of intents. And that will begin to be quite appealing, for example, to the Taliban, who were pushing far more towards the civil state, the Islam is stronger, but civil society in Afghanistan were pushing far more between Muwatana, the citizenship by state, and the other. So by and large, that's really where we come from. And to end, I want to say that our resources, Islamic resources, for being able to develop this would be, for example, from various chapters in the Quran, complemented by the prophetic practice. And so, what kind of charter did the Prophet draw up in Medina? How do we build an inclusive state that did not make Islam totalitarian? His final sermon was absolutely crucial because in that, amongst others, he guarantees the rights of inclusion of different racial, ethnic, and other cultural groups, as well as the inclusion of women in the body politic of society. And when we begin to speak prophetic and Quranic language, you get very little pushback. And so out of this, we were able to draw also on the credibility of the South African transition and the South African practice of how to fight injustice when you are under a system like apartheid. Are there borders to your fight? Secondly, how do you navigate a transition with wisdom? And thirdly, how do you build into your post-conflict state the rights and the freedoms and the developmental needs of your people? And I think that that really is what we try to do in this work. So I know your pressed for time, you're running late, but I thought that I will do that summary of what we did and why we did it and how we did it. Thank you very much.